Iran's foreign minister says the country has always stood against the United States' excessive demands and made great advances despite sanctions. Israel approves plans for the construction of over 1,000 new settler units in occupied city of Al-Quds. And Peru's political crisis deepens as lawmakers vote down a new bid to advance elections. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says the Iranian nation has relentlessly stood against the United States' excessive demands and has made great advances. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with the Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega in the capital city of Managua. Amir Abdullahian added that the sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. have made big problems for his country. However, he said Iran now stands among the developed countries by relying on its domestic capacities in various fields. Ortega, for his part, said the enemies of the global peace still continue their imperialist policies. He added that they want to turn the entire world into their backyard and have committed numerous crimes in the name of democracy. Amir Abdullahian has now departed for Venezuela on the next leg of his Central and South America's tour. And Iran has put on display dozens of domestically made nuclear equipment and products. The exhibition was attended by top nuclear scientists and Iran's nuclear chief. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The 53rd exhibition of Iran's nuclear industry achievements was inaugurated in Tehran on Thursday. The event showcases the latest nuclear products made in Iran. Attended by head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, the expo put on display different applications of the nuclear sector, from centrifuges to radiopharmaceuticals and particle accelerators.
Despite all external pressures, we have managed to advance our nuclear sector, and this expo shows a small part of it. Today, we have become self-sufficient in nuclear fuel, radio medicine, and many other fields such as heavy water.
In recent years, Iran has been trying to diversify the applications of its nuclear sector. Besides power generation, the country is now focusing on particle accelerators for food irradiation and radiotherapy.
Irradiation systems are being built in Iran on a national scale. This will allow the country to irradiate all its food and agricultural products. This way, we can reduce food waste, ensure food security for our people, and enhance our agricultural exports.
Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry in 2006, it has constantly been targeted by sanctions over what the West calls fears of a nuclear bomb, something which Tehran categorically rejects, saying its nuclear program is civilian and peaceful.
As you know, the West has long been leading a psychological campaign against Iran's nuclear activity, accusing Iran of pursuing non-peaceful purposes. So we held this exhibition for our people to see for themselves that our nuclear program is peaceful.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions against Tehran in 2018, Iran took retaliatory steps by scaling back its commitments to the pact. The Vienna discussions between Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal, which aimed to revive the accord, have remained stalled since August last year. This, as Tehran says, it will come back to full compliance only if Washington removes all its sanctions. By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions cannot disrupt its nuclear program. At the same time, the AEOI says it will continue to build up the country's nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits, if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The 1979 Islamic Revolution was meant to fulfill a long-cherished desire of independence for Iranians who had suffered decades of subjugation and domination by a monarchical rule with its nexus with some foreign powers. And one of the revolution's main promises was to keep the country away from all forms of dependence, either on the West or the East. The following report gives you an insight into the accomplishments of the Islamic Revolution and how it transformed Iranian society.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S. The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
Defying international outcry, Israel has approved plans to build about 1,200 settler units in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has endorsed two plans to build housing units and other structures for commercial and public purposes for Israeli settlers. The new structures will be built in six neighborhoods and settlements. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the regime's settlement plans as a crime and an attempt to change the status quo in Al-Quds. The movement said such Judaization projects will never legitimize the Israeli occupation. It added that Palestinians will continue to resist Israel's colonial plans until they liberate their ancestral land. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Some 120 Palestinian prisoners, meanwhile, have staged a hunger strike in Israeli jails. They are protesting the inhumane prison circumstances in the Negev Desert. Human rights groups have repeatedly expressed concern over the treatment of Palestinians in Israeli detention centers, and Palestinians have had no choice but to go on hunger strike to raise awareness about the violation of their most basic rights in Israeli jails.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that detention in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs.
Turning elsewhere now, the political crisis in Peru deepens as Congress rejects another proposal to bring forward elections to this year. Early elections is a key demand of protesters who have been hitting the streets of the country for several weeks now. The proposal had called for moving up elections from April 2024 to July this year. It had also called for a referendum on forming a constitutional convention. That's another demand of the protesters. The bill was put forward by President Dina Boluarte's Free Peru Party after the previous one was voted down by lawmakers. Last month, they voted to move up elections from 2026 to 2024, but the move failed to quell unrest. It broke out after former President Pedro Castillo was ousted and arrested over attempts to shut down Congress to avoid an impeachment. Nearly 50 have been killed in the protests calling for President Boluarte's resignation. U.S. House Republicans have voted to oust the Muslim lawmaker Ilhan Omar from a high-profile committee, accusing her of making, quote, anti-Semitic remarks. Omar, a Democrat, lost her position as a member of the House's Foreign Affairs Committee through a narrow margin vote of 218 to 211. The Republicans based their decision to oust her on Omar's 2019 remarks, in a tweet for which she had later apologized. In that tweet, she suggested that Israel's supporters in U.S. politics were motivated by money rather than principle. In an address to the session, Omar said there was still bias in the U.S. on the basis of people's original geographical location, religion, or skin tone.
There is this idea that you are a suspect if you are an immigrant, or if you are from certain parts of the world, or a certain skin tone, or a Muslim. It is no accident.
House Democrats believed that the ousting of Omar was revenge for removing two Republicans from committee assignments 2 years ago. They accused the Republicans of ignoring anti-Semitic comments from their own members. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said Omar's ouster was not about accountability for her past remarks, but it was about political revenge. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
يسرنا القرآن للذكر
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started explanation of Surah Munafiqun, and today we complete it. Revealed in Medina, it has 11 ayahs and takes its name from its main topic, Munafiqun, or the hypocrites. It declares that God bears witness that the hypocrites who pretend to be Muslim utter the false profession of faith only as a screen to hide their duplicity. The surah warns the believers of the treachery of the hypocrites and describes their behavior in some detail. Ayah 7 mentions a specific occasion on which the hypocrites tried to prevent the donating of money to the believers. And God calls on the Muslims to compensate for this by giving more of their own funds to the needy. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 7 and 8.
هم الذين يقولون لا تنفقوا على من عند رسول الله حتى ينفضوا ولله خزائن السماوات والأرض ولكن المنافقين لا يفقهون يقولون لئن رجعنا إلى المدينة ليخرجن الأعز منها الأذل ولله العزة ولرسوله وللمؤمنين ولكن المنافقين لا يعلمون.
They are the ones who say, do not spend on those who are with the Prophet of Allah until they scatter off, whereas to Allah belong the treasuries of the heavens and the earth. But the hypocrites do not understand. They say, when we return to the city, the mighty will surely expel the abased from it, while all might belongs to Allah and His Prophet, but the hypocrites do not know. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said hypocrites are the worst enemies who live among the believers and thus more dangerous than foreign enemies. The mission of the prophets and saints is to rescue sinners by guiding them to the path of virtue through encouragement of seeking repentance. We also said the Prophet is the means of intercession with God for the forgiveness of those who repent of their sins and misdeeds. The ayahs that we recited to you now point out that the hypocrites not only avoid helping the Prophet, they also prevent others from helping the Prophet on their various pretexts, on the assumption that people will abandon him. they fail to understand that the treasures of the heavens and the earth belong to Allah, the Almighty Creator, and no one can prevent what He grants. It was this lack of faith and short-sightedness on the part of the charlatan Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan, the usurper of the caliphate, to issue a decree to deny the followers of Imam Ali, peace upon him, any share of the public treasury. In modern times, the US and West European regimes impose economic sanctions and pressures to make the nations submit to their will. As Ayah 8 means to say, the hypocrites intend to overthrow the Islamic State, regard themselves better than the believers, and would say that if they succeed in seizing power in Medina, they will expel all the Muslims from the city. The hypocrites fail to understand that all power belongs to the Almighty Creator, which means honor and dignity is for those who are obedient to Almighty God. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, true believers never desert the Prophet and the religious leaders even when deprived of material benefits. Number two, those who evaluate everything according to power and wealth fail to understand sublime metaphysical realities. Number three, it is hypocrisy to consider others as inferior. And number four, in modern times, the US and the former European colonial regimes, on the assumption of their overblown political and economic power, impose sanctions on Iran and other countries which refuse to submit to their dictates. Now we invite you to listen to Ayah 9 of the same surah.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تلهكم أموالكم ولا أولادكم عن ذكر الله ومن يفعل ذلك فأولئك هم الخاسرون.
O you who have faith, do not let your possessions and children distract you from the remembrance of Allah. And whoever does that, it is they who are the losers. Since worldly possessions and children constitute one of the most significant factors behind love for the worldly life, this ayah warns the believers against such excessive affection. It is true that worldly possessions and children are divine bounties, and one can make use of them in Allah's cause in order to attain real prosperity. They, however, become the worst afflictions when excessive affection for family and material possessions impedes believers from treading the path of truth. One becomes a hypocrite if wholly engrossed in the material life and ignores duties towards God Almighty and the people. The same motive is most explicitly depicted in a narration from the Prophet's fifth infallible heir, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, according to which two wolves on either sides of a cattle may not inflict so much harm than the greed and avarice of a person. From this ayah we learn that number one, a faithful person regards the cause of God superior to everything and is ready to sacrifice material possessions and the family in the way of God if the need arises. And number two, the remembrance of the Almighty Creator and fulfilling of divine obligations are of paramount importance than excessive indulgence in pursuit of material wealth and possessiveness with family affairs to the extent that one ends up as a loser. We conclude this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment with a recitation of ayahs 10 and 11, which mark the end of Surah Munafiqun.
وَأَنفِقُوا مِمَّا رَزَقْنَاكُم مِّن قَبْلِ أَن يَأْتِيَ أَحَدَكُمُ الْمَوْتُ فَيَقُولَ رَبِّ لَوْلَا أَخَّرْتَنِي فيقول رب لولا أخرتني إلى أجل قريب فأصدق وأكن من الصالحين ولن يؤخر الله نفسا إذا جاء أجلها والله خبير بما تعملون.
Spend from what we have provided you before death comes to any of you. Whereat he will say, My Lord, why did you not respite me for a short time so that I might have given charity and become one of the righteous? But Allah will never respite a soul when its time has come. And Allah is well aware of what you do. These ayahs refer to the roots of hypocrisy that makes a person ignore divine commandments and refrain from spending on others while still alive from what God has provided. Whatever a person possesses is for a short time and as a trial and tribulation to determine whether or not these possessions are used and spent before death. Thus, niggardliness is meaningless. Upon taking a glimpse at the purgatory in the last moments, many people find out that they are at the threshold of the resurrection day, on death, and the removal of the veils of ignorance. Regret takes hold for the failure to make any provisions for the hereafter. Thus, such a person asks for return to worldly life even for a short while to compensate for the losses. But divine decree makes it impossible to return in view of the long respite that God had already given while alive. So how can we avoid such a fate? The solution is simple. God says we can spend on others and for a good cause from our possessions before death. The last ayah of the surah most decisively adds that God Almighty grants respite to none when the appointed time of death comes, not even for a single moment. Since the Almighty Creator is aware of all things, including our thoughts and intentions. From these ayahs, we learn that number one, the greatest loss is to ignore God and be negligent of His remembrance. Number two, it is hypocrisy and ingratitude to God's favors not to spend on the needy and for a good cause, as well as to prevent others from charity. And number three, when the time of death comes, there is no respite and no return to life upon death. So, to avoid regret in afterlife, we owe to be obedient to God's commandments by refraining from all vices and evil, including treason, sedition, and blasphemy. Dear listeners, Next week, we take up explanation of Surah Taghabun. Until then, God bless you and goodbye.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Europe remains in the grip of the worst cost of living crisis of the past 50 years, with staggering inflation and looming energy bills eroding wages for people across the continent. Over the past year, food and rental prices have gone up through the roof, while thousands of people are losing their job as a result of the energy crisis. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at European countries like the UK and France and see how their economies are suffering and whether there are any solutions on the horizon for Europe or not. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Limpet Opec, former British Member of Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Limpet Opec, first over to you. So I'm sure you saw, or maybe you were part of it, I don't know, but 500,000 people there in the London went on a strike. It's the largest strike in 12 years. We understand British teachers, civil servants, train drivers, university lecturers were part of that. What did you think about the strikes when you saw it in those numbers? Because that's rather large.
Well, it's affected me. The reason I'm sitting here in a coat outside is because I can't get where I want to go. The train drivers are also on strike. What we're seeing here is a general strike over a period of months. This isn't just one organized group of people who are saying that they're not happy with the current situation in the United Kingdom. It's actually millions of people who are not happy about that. We're basically observing a situation where the government has lost control of its relationship with the public. Any government has to rule with the consent of the public, and they are not having that at the moment, and that's the problem.
Well, Clive Menzies, the government says, according to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, that the pay rises need to be, quote, reasonable and affordable. And he went on to warn that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation. Do you agree with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak? And if not, what are your views on what is happening there in the UK when it comes to strikes?
Well, good evening. And I think this conversation has to be seen in the context of previous conversations, because this is a structural war that has been unfolding over the last 20 years. And more particularly, it's accelerated in the last 3 years. If we think back 3 years, people were applauding the NHS and clapping for the NHS in the midst of a mythical pandemic. And that was the structural collapse of the economy. Basically, they closed down, they sabotaged huge swathes of the economy. Meanwhile, we've had this massive increase in money supply, which is driving inflation through the roof. And this is deliberate sabotage. The UK government, Rishi Sunak, is, as we had a conversation, I think, in September, when I talked about Liz Truss. These are people who are, if you like, pigeons carrying the blame for what has been teed up over the preceding years. And so the government has no real power in this. They're basically trying to catch up with events that are unfolding, but they were predictable. We were predicting this in 2015. Interestingly, I was at a conference last night on emerging risks, in the city of London amongst financial people, and they too have very little idea of the sources of what's coming down the track as we speak. And part of the agenda is to create chaos and division, that people will blame each other for what's going on. But what is emerging amongst a growing number of people is a realization that we are in a war, and this is the war of the structure against ordinary people, people mm-hmm. like myself and others like me. And they are beginning to fight back in the form of not paying utility bills, not paying council tax, and basically developing their own networks for food supply, working with local farmers, looking at localized health solutions that are not reliant on the NHS. And basically what's emerging is a very nascent but an alternative to sure. what state and the structure cannot provide.
All right, a last question on the UK before we move on to other countries. Lampadopoulos, our guest raises a good point, I think, where he says that people are devising their own methods of how to tackle this. For example, not paying their utility bills. We know there was a movement of that recently. Also, the question, the bigger picture, I think, the question to you would be, at what point will the Sunak government realize that, hey, these strikes, not only are they growing in frequency, but the numbers are now beginning to swell to the point that it may bring the city down to a standstill, and therefore something needs to be done. I repeat what he has said, and I'm wondering what you think of it, where he has asked people who want pay rises to be reasonable and affordable, and that big pay rises would jeopardize attempts to tame inflation.
Well, I'm sitting here on a bench in the middle of London because I cannot get home because of the strikes. The specific answer to your question is they already know this. They recognize that they have lost control, and I agree with my colleague that there is a structural disconnect at the moment between government and the public. Fundamentally, what's going on here is the public and the organized unions don't any longer really have faith in governmental influence. Let's remember, we've actually got a former chancellor, who's only a chancellor briefly, who's responsible for £4.7 million of tax that he hadn't paid. When you've got that going on in government, then it's very difficult for the public to trust what's going on in Westminster.
On to France, Clive Menzies. France is into the conversation of this program because of the sheer numbers of people that took to the streets, anywhere from 1.27, some say, million people, or French, and some say up to 2 million. And this is over this pension reforms. Pension reforms has been always a controversial and a sticking point for any government in France. The plans to raise it to the age of 64. What are we looking at when we're looking at France, Clive Menzies, and the way that the cost of living crisis in this particular point, pension reform plans are going down?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between institutions and people. But we, like the French, like the Germans, like the Dutch, and like all the other European nations, have been under siege. And I think the French recognize this. If we go back to 2018 and the Gilets Jaunes process, it was very much structural assault on their way of life. And this has been going on for at least a couple of decades, if not much longer. And basically, people are getting to the point where they realize that there is no salvation within their government. I mean, Macron has been, I referred to the Gilets Jaunes protests and what provoked them as the pressure cooker being fired up. And this has been done progressively across Europe. And, you know, we're not just talking about France. We're talking about the attacks on Dutch farmers, the attacks on German living standards. I mean, Germans are basically being deindustrialized. There is a wholesale onslaught of both structural and kinetic violence that people are beginning to awake to. And not only that, they're beginning to awaken to the causes thereof. Nobody can be blind to the amount of greed and corruption that has been prevalent across all society, across all government institutions and related institutions. And people are noticing, and they're beginning to ask themselves, why are they reliant on these structures? And the only recourse out of this is to actually develop an alternative system. It was Buckminster Fuller, who is probably not someone familiar to many, but he wrote a book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. And one of the things that he famously said was, you don't fix something by trying to tinker with it from within. You create something new that will make it obsolete. And that's what's mm-hmm. beginning to happen. And that can only be a good thing. The unfortunate thing is that because of the structure in its death throes is becoming ever more desperate, things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. But certainly within my local area, there are people developing alternative systems to live with, which make them less reliant. And that is a global phenomenon, not just peculiar to North London. It's going on across England and it's going on across the world. There are self-organizing societies in France, in Spain, in Mexico, right, among others. And I'm sure there are many more.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
There are other countries, and we could talk about each country since there are quite a few of them in the European Union, Lepidopic. What is that going to do if I just throw you an inflation figure, for example, and that they're not they're experiencing cost of living crisis? One of the things not talked about Lepidopic, and I'd like to find out what you can tell us if you can, is a thing called greedflation, greed with a D, corporate profits soaring. The sectors that it seems like that's happening in are, you're looking at energy, you're looking at things like the food, from what I'm understanding, the technology sector and luxury sectors, where they're enjoying an unprecedented amount of cash bonanza, if you want to call it. This is on the backs of people, so they're taking advantage of what's happening. Of course, the one that really stands out is in the energy sector. Isn't there anything that's being done there in the UK to start off with, and other places? I mean, I'm looking at, for example, how these energy firms have made combined total profit of 75.9 billion euros over the first 9 months of 2022.
First of all, something can be done. I know nothing serious is being done. Let me explain that. And let's just take the energy sector example as a case in point. The reason that the energy sector is making so much money is the idiotic and stupid policies in the West when it comes to energy. You can't run a modern economy with solar panels and turbines. I know we're not discussing claims about climate crisis right now, but however you power society, that's not the way you can do it. And Germany, which has had a very green, and you mentioned Germany, it's got very green credentials, it claims, it's going back to coal. So what we're seeing here is an ideology virtue signaling causing a massive increase in the cost of energy. The second and perhaps even more important point here is politicians are very bad at making technological decisions, and there are no sensible decisions being made at the moment. If you want a clean grid, you need to go for nuclear and potentially tidal as well if you've got water. You don't do it by simply waving a flag in the sky. The sun will always shine even at night. So if you add all that together, the West has now got an energy crisis, and then of course it depended on its arch enemy Russia to get cheap gas. That's a recipe for it's a perfect storm, and you can't have it both ways. You don't declare war on your best energy friend and pretend that you can't get a bad result from that.
Please tell us what you think about the energy factor, Glad-Menzies, when it affects obviously all countries. And this is something that has inflation as a consequence when we take a look at the energy. I guess I can call it a crisis because we're still looking at it. Explain to us what is going on there. There's some coverage on that where it says Europe is not doing that badly. They were able to meet their energy needs. But many, I think, don't realize that they're going through the reserves. And that problem still exists.
Well, I think Lembit's exactly right. There is an ideological problem that underpins this, and that's the phony climate crisis, which has created this environment of what's called ESG, environment and social and governance, which basically all businesses have to comply with or they'll go out of business, according to Mark Carney, who's the UN's climate envoy. Let's think about what we're talking about. We're talking about energy and food. Energy is what's built our civilization and allows us to live what is, in relative terms, a very fairly sophisticated lifestyle. Food is essential for life, come what may. And undoubtedly, there has been a lot of price gouging going on. If you look at, I drive a petrol-driven car and I drive past the pumps on a regular basis and see the price is fluctuating, but actually they bear no relationship to the underlying oil price, which actually is back where it started before the so-called invasion. Another major factor is the sanctions that are basically self-imposed flagellation by Europe in participating in these sanctions on Russia, as Lembit alluded to. There are plenty of customers for Russian oil and Russian gas and Russian food, and those customers are in India, in China and elsewhere. And if Europe really wants to turn itself into an impoverished backward society, they seem to be going about it in exactly the right way. Undoubtedly, the oil companies and food distribution companies, not only are there attacks on food distribution, but they're profiteering as well. But the only solution is to get back to as close as to where you can access your own food. For example, energy is a bit more of a problem.
Sure.
But we ought to at least call out the lies that are surrounding the war in Ukraine that's been going on since 2014. It didn't start last year. It started by NATO in 2014.
So let's look at some of the figures, Lembit Opec. You're looking at inflation, 11.5% across the European Union. That's a breaking point. Wages, well, the average annual energy bill, it's a month's wage for low-paid workers in the majority of the EU member states. Food banks shot up in the past months. Italy, as an example, 85,000 people, low-paid workers, is another concern where they are hit hardest by this crisis. I'm forging all these stats into one because, as you said, they're aware of this. The governments are aware of this. So where is that threshold? When is it going to be a breaking point where they feel threatened, where people power is going to overtake the streets, is going to overtake institutions, and there's going to be pushback? Because, yeah, we're looking at Europe, some of these protests, I mean, like the ones in France, it's almost like a party sometimes. But then again, it's not. Some of the scenes you see, the police obviously taking matters in their own hand to control some of the violence. But when is that threshold going to break? When is that line going to be crossed?
Yeah. On the first point, what we are now seeing is companies who are profiteering. You're right. And I agree very much with my colleague this evening that, that they are making exceptional profits, but that's their job. They're not charities. They want to make a lot of money, and they've got the opportunity to do it. In terms of the breaking points question, it's not a number, it's a state of mind. The issue here is that the public, all around me, not just me, many other people can't get home tonight, they'll have to spend a fortune, maybe on taxis. There comes a point where, and it won't be far away, where people say, this is enough now. We are going to take this into our own hands. So you get away from political power to people power. There's a group I met yesterday called Together. And they are basically saying, we don't care what party you're in, Mr. or Mrs. MP. We care about the fact that we pay you to do a job for us and you're not doing it. How long till people have had enough? I would say 4 to 6 months, certainly before the next general election. I would say for the next election, there will be a big change, and political parties will be less important than how people feel about individual politicians. I'll give you one example. They wanted diesel vehicles in Britain. I don't think they can do it. Once the public realizes that's going to happen and essentially takes their choice of mobility away, the public will say, if you don't let me drive my car, I won't let you get reelected.
Okay. Final question, Clive Menzies. I'm not sure what word to use, but it appears that the EU is moving down a path that is being somewhat, many say, dictated by the U.S. when it comes to Russia, for example. And if we're going to see any change there, which we then can conclude, okay, sigh of relief, things are going to maybe go back to normal, the U.S. has China on its mind, which means that things are not going to get back to normal. Are we looking at the U.S., the core of some of these problems that exist in terms of it wanting to defeat Russia or weaken Russia, and therefore the EU is being led down that path?
Well, our analysis over the last dozen or so years reveals that actually, although America seems to be all powerful, America is not in control. Money power controls everything. Central banks around the world collude to manage economics, and money power through foundations and various levers of power exert their will, whether it be through congressmen who are bought off or members of parliament. So everybody is enthralled to money, and that is what is running things. And what goes on in terms of geopolitics is very much money playing both sides. And obviously, different countries wander off the reservation, as it were, from time to time. So Hitler wandered off the reservation in the 1930s, and that's why World War II started. Although it was a deliberate means to take it down. And the same with Russia and China. These are geopolitical games. These are not accidental. They are contrived. And people are awakening to the fact that their politicians are powerless in this respect.
Thank you. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. We have to let Lem Pidopic get back to his home, hopefully. Lem Pidopic, thank you very much. Former British Member of Parliament from London. Thank you. And also from London, Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst there from London also. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tafway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved.